KUT and KUTX listeners, the stream you've connected to is going silent on April 20th. You're likely using an old bookmark, app, or link that's been around a long time. Please visit kut.org/streams. That's kut.org/streams for more information. If you're still hearing this message next time you listen, there's a form at the bottom of that page that you can fill in for help. Our websites, apps, and npr.org are updated, so you can tune in there. Thank you for listening and supporting our stations.
This is KUT Weekend for the first weekend of May 2016. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier. Here's what we got for you this week. Texas Republicans reacting to Donald Trump clearing the Republican presidential field.
I do not believe that Donald Trump embodies the fundamental issues that are important to Republicans like myself.
One last look at Proposition 1 before Austin voters decide ride-hailing rules.
Lyft said if Prop 1 fails, they will leave 5 a.m. Monday.
And a new inconspicuous Italian restaurant on East 2nd Street.
It's not very ostentatious or showy. Not a lot about the style on the outside.
Those stories and more in this edition of KUT Weekend. But first, a reminder to subscribe to this podcast at weekend.kut.org. That's where you find links to iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and RSS, our feeds for those. And if you can, please leave us a review in the Apple Podcasts app or in the iTunes store. If you have any questions or comments, you can email news@kut.org. My direct email is nathan@kut.org. And feel free to say hi on Twitter. I'm @KUTNathan. Okay, this was a pretty big week in the history of American politics. I don't need to tell you that. You already know by now who is the apparent Republican presidential nominee. But the Texas story was this guy saying this.
But with boundless optimism for the long-term future of our nation, we are suspending our campaign. But hear me now. I am not suspending our fight for liberty.
You know who that was, U.S. Senator Ted Cruz of Texas, bowing out after losing the Indiana primary. So we wondered what it would mean for Republicans in Texas, because so many are diehard Cruz supporters. Cruz won the Texas primary easily. Well, Governor Greg Abbott posted on Facebook that conservatives must unite behind the Republican nominee, but he didn't actually say Donald Trump's name in that post. Texas Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, who once said he could never vote for Trump, wrote an op-ed for the Texas Tribune this week saying Republicans should support Donald Trump because Trump favors increased border security, ending Obamacare, and creating jobs. So what about Republicans in Travis County? There's not a lot of them. Excluding, of course, those congressional districts that are gerrymandered to have tiny little slices of Travis County. But there is a Republican on the Travis County Commissioner's Court who will appear on the ballot with Trump in November. Gerald Doherty didn't return my voicemail requesting comment. Don Zimmerman is a conservative on the city council. He's involved with the Travis County Republican Party. He will be on the ballot in November. Local political consultant David Butts once called him in The Statesman. He called Zimmerman the Donald Trump of Austin because of Zimmerman's tendency to say controversial, non-politically correct things. When I got through to Zimmerman's office, his aide asked Zimmerman if he wanted to comment on Trump, and Zimmerman declined. But I did get through to Republican State Representative Paul Workman, and his district includes much of western Travis County.
I guess, first off, I'm just curious to get your reaction about this pretty historic development in American politics and for the Republican Party.
It's definitely an interesting year, isn't it, when it comes to politics. Presidential politics, that's for sure.
I mean, are you going to be supporting Donald Trump as the Republican nominee? Do you have reservations? How do you feel about where we're at?
Well, he is not my choice, but if he is our nominee in November, then I'll support him, sure.
What do you do if voters ask you about, for example, how you feel about his call for a temporary ban on foreign Muslims entering the country, or some of his more controversial policies such as that?
Yeah, I just suggest that they need to talk to him about that, that's not something that I'm prepared to weigh in on at this point. I'm going to have my own race. I'm going to have to focus on my own race and the things that are important to District 47 in the state of Texas.
However, some Republicans are outright rejecting the Trump nomination. The loudest voice on this, I think, was State Representative Jason Villalba. from the Dallas area. He wrote an op-ed in the Texas Tribune saying Trump is the death of the Republican Party. He called Trump a, quote, buffoonish, clownish, orange, carnival-barking, snake oil salesman, end quote. So I called Representative Villalba to find out what he really thinks.
I do not believe that Donald Trump embodies or supports or champions the fundamental issues that are important to Republicans like myself and frankly all Republicans. The Republican label means something. We stand for something. We care about limited government and protecting the unborn and protecting Second Amendment rights and lowering taxes and lowering regulations. This individual, either through his past statements or through things that he said on the campaign trail, clearly does not define himself in that way at all. He has not given us any indication whether or not he supports those things, and in fact, on certain instances, he said the opposite. And so while I remain a conservative Reagan Republican, I just cannot, in good conscience, support an individual who I do not believe is a Republican.
Okay, well, if Mr. Trump is that bad of a candidate, I mean, isn't Dan Patrick and Governor Abbott, aren't they doing harm to the party by trying to unite behind him?
Absolutely not. No. Both Governor Abbott and Lieutenant Governor Patrick have a duty to the party to make sure that we all get and support the remaining candidates on the ballot, including our presidential nominee. I think they play a role that's different than my role. You know, they are the leaders of the state party, and I have great respect for both of them for what they're trying to achieve.
Well, I mean, but you're calling him a disgusting blight on the American experience.
Look, from what I've seen from this man during this campaign, I'm troubled by a number of things. One of the ones that was most troubling for me was the blatant misogyny, calling a woman a dog or making references to Megyn Kelly that were disturbing. You know, also denigrating our men and women in uniform who were war heroes. These are the kinds of things that I'm deeply troubled by from our commander-in-chief. And so it's unlikely that this person will be able to win me over. But
right.
Look, I think he's going to win. I think he's going to win other people over, and maybe not me, but others, because he's been so good at bringing people to the polls that haven't historically voted before.
But you know Texas politics well, and do you think that his brand of conservatism aligns well with the limited government, social conservative strand of Republican politics that dominates in Texas?
I don't sense that. I don't sense that he really has gained a foothold in, let's call them the Liberty Caucus or the Tea Party Caucus, whatever you want to name them. I don't think that they have adopted him in any form or fashion.
So when you hear that kind of talk from conservative Republicans in Texas, does it mean that this state could become a little less reliably Republican red? KUT's Ben Philpott looks at that.
The assumption that Donald Trump will face off against Hillary Clinton has people predicting a tough time for Republicans down ballot. But does that mean Texas Republicans are in trouble? Matthew Dowd says no, at least not in 2016. He's the chief political analyst for ABC News and was the chief strategist for President George W. Bush's reelection campaign in 2004.
In places like Texas, where there's red monopolies, and even in places like California or New York, where you feel like there's blue monopolies, I think Donald Trump's nomination as the Republican Party's standard bearer is going to accelerate independent candidacies around the country, including Texas.
So if a much-rumored third-party conservative runs in the 2016 election, and if the GOP doesn't reunite soon after, 2020 could see a rise of additional breakaway candidates in state races. But first things first, we've got 6 months until Election Day. Ben Philpott, KUT News.
6 long months. So you can hear more from Matthew Dowd on the 2016 election on the latest episode of The Ticket 2016, a presidential podcast. It's Ben's podcast he does with Jay Root from the Texas Tribune. You can subscribe to that on iTunes and listen online at theticket2016.com. East Riverside Drive in Austin has become a hotspot for new housing development. A lot of stuff going up there. But retailers in the area are not keeping pace with the increase in demand. KUT's Saida Hassan has a look.
Real estate broker Jim Young started researching the East Riverside corridor for his clients, and he noticed a surprising trend playing out in the area. Residents were spending their money in other parts of the city.
They call it leakage, and that simply means that people have to drive outside of the trade area to satisfy that need.
Young is a partner at the Austin-based Longbow Real Estate Group. He pulled data from the research company Esri, looking at the area within a 5-minute drive of 2015 East Riverside Drive. That's the location of a strip center that houses the music venue Emo's. Young found that residents often had to drive outside that area to find the things they wanted.
There's, you know, approximately $92 million worth of additional demand, or what we would call opportunity, in that drive time. That's really significant if you are a retailer or an investor thinking of purchasing a retail center, to know that there is opportunity there.
From luxury condos to single-family homes, new housing developments continue to crop up in the area. But Young says surrounding retailers aren't meeting the increased demand that stems from that growth. More specifically, there's a $52 million gap in the area's general merchandise market, retailers like department stores. Young thinks much of that gap stems from recent demographic changes.
There are so many new residents moving into the area who want to go to breweries and restaurants, and they would be purchasing clothes to go out on Town Lake, or business suits. Whereas before, you had a lower middle income, and now you've got a lot higher income.
In the near future, Young thinks the neighborhood may see an even bigger retail gap. One of his clients has bought land for a 400-unit apartment complex in the area. The tech giant Oracle also has plans to build a new campus in the neighborhood and purchase an apartment building to house employees.
I think it may increase slightly, for the next 12 to 18 months, or until some developers come in and put up some really interesting new retail centers.
But Young thinks it's a matter of time before that gap is closed and we see even more construction on Riverside. He says there's just too much opportunity for developers to pass up. Saida Hassan, KUT News.
Tomorrow is Decision Day on Austin's Proposition 1. This is the ballot initiative that will determine ride-hailing regulations in Austin for companies such as Uber and Lyft. And it has been a pretty divisive debate in Austin. Also, the most expensive campaign in the history of municipal politics, at least on one side. So we wanted to run down this proposition, what it means for Austin, one last time before voting day. And joining me to do that is KUT's Audrey McGlinchey, who has been reporting a lot on this. Are you doing okay, Audrey?
I'm doing okay. I'm hanging in there, Nathan.
Okay. So let's get this out of the way first. Proposition 1, what does it mean to vote for it and to vote against it?
So a vote for Proposition 1 is a vote that would allow both Uber and Lyft and any ride-hailing company that were to come into the city after them to conduct their own background checks. Now, Uber and Lyft do these through third parties. These background checks would have to be national in scope, and the party that does them would have to be approved by the city. A for vote also means that trade dress, so that's, Uber has those stickers, Lyft has those pink mustaches, would not be required to be shown on these vehicles. A vote for also requires a fee, an annual fee to the city that is 1% of the company's annual revenue. There's also a bunch of little nuanced pieces in there, but those are the big ones.
And the for vote is essentially for an ordinance drafted by Uber and Lyft, but it's very similar to one that was adopted by the Austin City Council in 2014. At the time, it was considered a temporary ordinance.
Yeah, it's often been referred to as Leffingwell's rules, which I actually think Chris Riley came up with.
Yeah, it's more like Riley's rules.
Yeah. And certainly as the former mayor has come into the for campaign, I think it's taken on that title. But yeah, they're very similar to the rules passed in 2014 and the rules that companies operated under for roughly a year and a half here in Austin. Currently, we're under the new council's rules, and maybe that can lead us into what an against vote means.
Tell me about it.
Sure. So an against vote is a vote favoring current rules, what council passed in December, and that would require fingerprint-based background checks for Uber and Lyft and any ride-hailing company that comes into the city or is already here. And these background checks would be national in scope. They would be run through the FBI. And the city has indicated that they would possibly use a third party to collect these fingerprints. A vote against would also require trade address the thing I mentioned before, those pink mustaches, those stickers, require that all cars show them. A vote against gives ride-hailing companies options for the fee that they would have to pay. So either way, the city would still have a fee paid to them. That amount would just differ if you vote against this rule.
And importantly, Uber and Lyft have said that if the proposition fails, they will leave Austin.
Absolutely. Uber and Lyft have said time and again that if the against vote prevails, if Prop 1 fails, that they will leave the city of Austin. Lyft yesterday actually put a deadline on that. They said if Prop 1 fails, they will leave 5 a.m. Monday. This was in a text sent out to drivers yesterday, Thursday.
But Uber hasn't given a hard date on when they will leave, right? And they do operate in Houston under a fingerprint background check.
Yes. So Lyft does not operate in any city that requires fingerprinting. They do operate in New York City, which does fingerprinting, but it's through a whole nother system.
Sure.
But Uber does operate in Houston, which requires fingerprints, though as of about a week and a half ago, they alerted the mayor of Houston that they would be leaving after operating under fingerprints for roughly a year and a half, saying, hey, it's no longer working for us. Our business is not going great. We're going to have to leave. As of talking with you here, Nathan, they're still there. So, you know, they after that threat, they've stayed around. So we'll see, you know, if they decide to leave Austin, if this fails.
Why are they against fingerprinting?
The companies say that fingerprinting is too burdensome for drivers. You know, the whole kind of setup is that you can get a background check through their third party. It's quick, it's fast, it's easy. You use your name and social security number. And hey, you can start driving really quickly. And they argue that a lot of their drivers are part-time. I think Uber says 50% of their drivers only drive for 10 hours a week. So the whole idea is that we don't want to send our drivers through this whole rigmarole if this isn't a full-time job, if they're not making the majority of their income for this. This is just a side gig. Let's make it easy for them. I haven't yet seen definitive proof that fingerprinting is certainly burdensome. I know the city has said time and again they would do all that they could to make it easy on drivers. You know, Uber came out with a report in Houston, but Houston thoroughly refutes that fingerprinting is as burdensome as they say it is.
The report in Houston said what exactly?
So the report in Houston said there was a four-month backlog on drivers. Uber said that in Houston, because of fingerprinting, we don't have enough drivers to service our riders. The city of Houston has thoroughly refuted that, saying that there's not such a backlog, that it takes on average, I think they said, 7 days to get through the system. One side saying one, the other side saying the other, so who knows?
Well, let me ask you about money, because there has been a lot of it spent on this campaign by the Political Action Committee Ride Sharing Works for Austin, which is funded by Uber and Lyft. How much have they spent?
So I think at last count, just under $9 million they've spent on this campaign. And that actually does not include the money spent on the petition to get this
right
onto a public vote. But yeah, it's been a ton of money. A lot of that has been spent on advertising. They brought in several political consultants.
Mostly Republican political consultants?
Well, they would refute that, but the outsiders they have brought in have been Republicans. Yes, we have folks who've worked with Rick Perry. We have folks who've worked on Bush campaigns. More of the local folks are Democrats, like Huey Ray Fisher, who ran for State House District 49. So, yeah, there's been...
So it's a mix.
It's a mix, yeah.
What about the other side? It's really just not even comparable in terms of political spending, right?
It's really not, and I honestly have kind of stopped keeping track of the other side because it feels like pennies in comparison. But at last count, I think they had raised roughly, I want to say, $150,000. It is notable that 5,000 of those contributions is coming from Houston taxis, which is interesting.
Hmm.
But 5,000 versus, you know, the roughly 9 million, which has only been coming from Uber and Lyft. It's important to mention the other side has not received any donations from private citizens.
We had 9 days of early voting, so those ballots are already cast. How's turnout?
During early voting, we saw 10% of registered voters here in Austin turn out to the polls. So that's about 58,000 voters. Generally, historically, more folks come out for Election Day, which is Saturday. So we'll expect to see a lot more votes cast. But when we get those early voting numbers in, I think it should possibly indicate where we're headed.
We'll find out Saturday night, of course. We have a special here on KUT Saturday night from 8 to 9. But if Prop 1 passes, obviously the ordinance drafted by Uber and Lyft becomes an official city regulation. How long until city council could modify that if they wanted to?
So if Prop 1 passes, the city council could not challenge that or modify it at all within the next 2 years. There's a 2-year waiting period on any initiative passed here in the city. So it's going to be accepted as it is, and that will be law for 2 years.
If Proposition 1 fails, and Uber and Lyft leave, can the city council modify it if they wish to attempt to lure them back?
So if Prop 1 fails, there's kind of a little more wiggle room. That means we'd be going with the council ordinance. So the council does have the ability to modify their own ordinance. And the mayor has come out and said he, if Prop 1 fails, he will try to continue compromising with these companies because, as Uber and Lyft have said, they will leave if it fails. So, you know, we could, if Prop 1 fails, we could be in for a few more months of talking about this and talking about what rules these companies will live under.
Hopefully you can take a few days off before you have to start covering that.
Oh, don't worry.
As I mentioned, KUT will be providing live coverage Saturday night from 8 to 9 on the results of this election. Tune in for that or stream it at KUT.org. If you have more questions about this issue, check out Audrey's reporting. She has done so many stories on this, and you can find all of them at KUT.org. Audrey, thank you for everything.
Thanks so much, Nathan.
Now that Texas knows it will receive a Medicaid waiver for uncompensated care, the health care delivered to people who show up at the emergency room and can't afford to pay, state lawmakers are no longer on a tight deadline to figure out what to do about the large uninsured population in this state, highest in the country. According to the feds, the federal government will continue to give the state billions of dollars to reimburse hospitals who have to pay to care for people who don't have health insurance. But the deal only pushed the deadline back a year to December 2017. KUT's Ashley Lopez reports that advocates hope lawmakers will use that time to debate Medicaid expansion.
Ann Dunkelberg with the Center for Public Policy Priorities says the Medicaid waiver extension was good news for healthcare providers in the state. No doubt about that. But
I think it's a terrible mistake to believe that it is going to change the ultimate course of sort of the modernizations of Medicaid that Texas needs to be looking at over the next few years.
One of those modernizations is born out of the Affordable Care Act. Here's the key point in that fight. The state wants a Medicaid waiver to pay hospitals for taking care of people without health insurance. The feds argue, hey, expand Medicaid under the ACA and that uncompensated care cost drops. But state lawmakers have to approve that expansion. And the state's conservative leadership has opposed expansion and all other parts of the law since it was passed. But Democratic State Representative Garnett Coleman of Houston says it's time to revisit this conversation and perhaps even find a middle ground.
Meaning some form of coverage expansion that respects the fact that we have conservative leadership in this state.
And Coleman hopes Medicaid coverage expansion becomes a big part of the conversation as state and federal health officials continue to meet over what to do with the state's large uninsured population.
These are ongoing discussions, and they have to be, because of the 1.1 million people who don't have health insurance that could have it under a coverage expansion. And that's not solved until we figure out some way to work with our federal partners to do that. This is truly a Band-Aid for our hospitals, not a guarantee of a sustained dollars based on somebody walking in with an insurance card.
But the fact that the state has been successful in getting the federal government to extend the waiver could make Medicaid expansion a harder sell. Already, the state's healthcare agency has said they hope to convince federal officials to give them yet another waiver extension after this one. Here's Brian Black, a spokesman with the Health and Human Services Commission here in Texas.
And in the meantime, HHSC and CMS will continue to look at extending this possibly to another 5 years. We'll just see how long that extension goes.
Federal health officials have warned that funding pools for programs in the state's Medicaid waiver will start being phased out in 2018. State lawmakers don't meet again until January of next year. Ashley Lopez, KUT News.
The Texas Attorney General is cautioning the head of the Target Corporation about its recent policy change regarding restroom use. KUT's Trey Schar has the letter and reaction.
Ken Paxton sent a letter to Target CEO Brian Cornell warning him about the policy of welcoming transgender team members and guests to use the restroom or fitting room facility that corresponds to their gender identity. Paxton says, quote, allowing men in women's restrooms could lead to criminal and otherwise unwanted activity. CC Gratias is president and CEO of the Austin Gay and Lesbian Chamber of Commerce and says Paxton's concern may be misplaced.
There's already laws about harassment and assaults, whether you are in a restroom or not in a restroom. I think it encourages people who are against any of this public accommodation laws to actually just harass people.
In his letter, Paxton asks for the full text of Target's safety policies. He wants to know how Target will protect, quote, women and children from those who would use the cover of Target's restroom policy for nefarious purposes, end quote. Paxton says Target is currently free to choose that kind of policy for its Texas stores, adding that the legislature may address the issue. Trey Shar, KUT News.
The Dallas suburb of Rockwall this week rejected a proposal by that city's mayor that would have regulated bathroom use. The proposal would have required people to use the bathroom that corresponds to the sex on their birth certificate, not the gender with which they identify, and it proposed a fine of up to $500. Of course, this is intended to target transgender people. Christopher Connolly reports from Rockwall.
What do we want?
Peace.
About 70 advocates for transgender rights gathered in front of Rockwall City Hall to oppose the so-called bathroom bill. They said the bill endangers transgender people. Inside, the council chambers and the overflow room were packed. Rockwall County Attorney Kenda Culpepper said the bill is needed since corporations like Target and Planet Fitness announced policies to allow people to use the restroom they felt appropriate.
This is about sexual predators that will use this issue or these policies of businesses encouraging people to use whatever restroom that they feel like using that day. They will use that as an excuse to get into the bathroom to possibly assault children.
Brenda Rogenkamp fired back. She says her transgender daughter is not a boy in a girl's dress, not a pervert, and not a predator.
I will not stand by as my child and other transgender children in this community are made second-class citizens because of governmental overreach.
Mayor Jim Pruitt, who proposed the ordinance, said it was purely about security, not discrimination. But in the end, Pruitt failed to get traction from his fellow council members. His council colleague, David White, said he opposed the bill as soon as he heard about it.
Leave me alone, I'll leave you alone. That's my political philosophy. And this did not do that. It got into the business of where people get rid of their bodily waste. And I think that's kind of the most ridiculous thing I've seen the city of Rockwall get involved with in the 5 years I've been on council.
After the council's decision, advocates for transgender rights hugged in celebration. But it was tempered by anticipation of more bathroom bills in other Texas towns. A Lufkin City Council member said Sunday he'd introduce a similar bill there.
That's Christopher Connolly with Dallas Public Radio Station KERA. Meanwhile, just for some contrast, here in Austin, the city council this week passed a measure that aims to increase sensitivity to transgender people among members of the Austin Police Department. So this measure creates a study group to look at improving how transgender and gender nonconforming individuals are identified by the Austin Police Department, along with recommending any proposed changes in policy and training. The vote by the Austin City Council came after a killing in January of Monica Leora, a transgender woman whom police initially identified by her male name. The measure approved was brought by Councilmember Greg Kassar.
And I appreciate council support on this effort, considering that in other parts of the state and parts of this country, councils are considering very anti-LGBTQ legislation. And I think that it's important for Austin to keep on showing that we're not taking our status as a pretty friendly city and inclusive city for granted, that there are lots of ways that we can get better.
That study group has to report back to the Austin City Council no later than August 4th. There is a maxim in the news business that you're never supposed to describe the weather as good or bad because someone's beautiful sunny day might be an umbrella salesman's worst nightmare or whatever. I'm going to bend the rules a bit here and say the weather in Austin this week was exceptional. April, however, was quite rainy, and there is the possibility of rain in the forecast next week. During one of those deluges we got in April, you might have noticed rain seems to fall in the middle of the night quite often. KUT's Moz Bushel has always wondered why.
Yeah, I'm lying in bed. I've woken up yet again to the sound of thunder and rain. It's like this weather's designed to keep me from getting sleep. That's when I usually think, if only Time Warner Cable News' Burton Fitzsimmons were here.
So we're tracking a severe thunderstorm right now, right in the Austin area, and it does look like it's going to be.
You could really help explain things.
And maybe a little bit of hail. Hey, Moz.
Hey, Burton.
It's me.
This must be some kind of crazy dream.
Well, I'm glad to join you for this dream while the thunderstorms are in progress.
Burton, do you have an answer? Does it really rain more at night?
It seems that way lately, doesn't it?
But tell me why, Burton.
Think about the hot, dry desert air that's out there in West Texas. And here we have this very muggy, warm air. Well, the dividing line between those two air masses is like a little front.
Okay.
It usually is the heat of the day that starts it all out there in West Texas, right in the middle of the afternoon. And so it really takes until the nighttime hours for some of those storms to get to us. And by the time they make it up to I-35, it is sometimes right in the middle of your dream.
Whoa, that's crazy. So we have humid air in the eastern part of the state, dry air in the west. When they meet, we get storms, but they meet way out west and form those storms in the afternoon. So by the time they move east, it's usually night.
Yeah, well, now you know why it might be storming in the middle of the night, and then you wake up. Wake up. Wake up. Wake up. Wake up.
Wake up. Wake up, Moz. Moz, wake
hey,
up.
Hey, Jen Staten. I must have nodded off at my desk.
Yeah, again.
Yeah.
But Moz, you know, you had a story due this morning. You know, the one about the weather and why
it
rained?
You know what, Jen? Don't worry about it. I think it's been taken care of. Unless I'm still dreaming? Moz Bushel, KUT News.
The downtown east side has seen tremendous growth over the past several years with new residential developments and restaurants popping up, and they don't always blend in with the neighborhood that's been there for generations, but there's a new Italian restaurant that's trying to fit in with its surroundings, and joining us to talk about it is Austin American Statesman restaurant critic Matthew Odom. Hey, Matthew.
Hey there, Nathan.
What is this place you're reviewing this week?
It's called Alfico, and it's a restaurant from Jeff Currington and Kelly Bell, who own Vino Vino up here, just near Hyde Park off Guadalupe.
And what does it look like in your piece you write about how you kind of had some trouble finding it?
Right. Vino Vino, I think, is a great neighborhood wine bar. This is, you know, there's a neighborhood restaurant, and then there's like disappearing into the neighborhood. It's kind of a slate gray brick building. We walked there the other evening from a dance performance and actually walked right by it, didn't even realize we were passing a restaurant, and then we circled back and figured out the entrance was kind of inside this gated parking lot. So unlike some new restaurants in town, especially some of the Italian restaurants, it's not very ostentatious or showy, not a lot about the style on the outside.
It's on East 2nd near Chalmers. And the vibe is what? Like, inside, very casual, or how is it?
It's casual. There's white tablecloths, but it's really casual. You've got some wood paneling, the black and white checkered floor, which kind of harkens to osterias in Italy. There are a lot of black and white images from a trip the owners took to Italy, I believe, last year, throughout the space, really kind of crowding every inch of the wall there. It's almost more of like that hideout kind of vibe than it is, you know, a big showy restaurant. So it's kind of cozy in that regard. And then there's also a nice little area outside, a kind of sidewalk courtyard seating area where we had a really nice lunch as well.
Now to the meat of the issue, the menu. What are they serving? What is it like?
It's very pizza and pasta oriented. There's some antipasti, of course, none of which I was too crazy about. Some burrata bruschetta, which was fine, I guess, and some very tender but unbound meatballs. They're fine, but I think my real interest was in the pizza and the pastas, which make up the majority of the menu.
And those were good?
Yeah, they were. They're described as Roman style, although they're a little crunchier and not as quite as supple as Roman pizzas that I'm familiar with. There was one that has a really nice tangy anchovy pesto on a sausage pizza with eggplant and pine nuts. That was a nice change of pace. There was another one that had a soft layer of taleggio and mozzarella on the bottom of the pizza, then covered with these waves of prosciutto and little shards of radicchio, and it was all lacquered in this sweet red wine reduction. It was a little too sweet for my buddy, but I liked it.
What about the pastas? How are those?
The pastas I really liked. They're all homemade. There was a big, massive raviolo, kind of bronzed with brown butter. It was a duck egg raviolo and laced with carrots and kale and arugula and marsala braised mushrooms. That was really nice. There were some firm triangle pastas with eggplant puree. They were stuffed with smoked mozzarella, which was a nice surprise. And then there were some that were, you know, kind of left field. There was a rye tortellini that was stuffed with fragrant pork and prosciutto sausage and a caraway broth. So those were nice. I liked the pastas the most of everything there.
Anything you didn't like about the menu?
Not crazy about the desserts. They kind of felt a bit like afterthoughts. There was a gummy baked ricotta pie, this kind of spongy lemon torta, and a chocolate budino about which I was not crazy. So that was kind of disappointing. But, you know, a fan of the pasta, like the pizzas.
Price-wise?
You know, you're looking at teens for the pastas, and you can order entree size of the pasta or order it as a preemie. The entrees are in the low 20s. The pizzas are around $12 to $14.
Overall, I mean, does Austin need another Italian place like this?
You know, it's a really comfortable place, and the service is really friendly. It has an interesting all-Italian wine list that they're really passionate about, so it can be a fun hang. I saw one of your coworkers there actually one evening with a group of friends, and it's a good place.
Who was it? I want to know.
I'll never tell.
Okay.
And it's a good place to go with a group, I think. There were some young men there with their mothers having a good time. I saw a group of four guys in middle-aged enjoying some wine together. So it's a fun vibe. It's not kind of as showy and CNBC seen as some of these other right. places around town. And again, it's tucked away over there in the neighborhood. I'm not sure if lunch is going to catch on, but I could see it being a viable dinner option, especially at those price points.
The restaurant is El Fico. It's on East 2nd Street near Chalmers. And you can read Matthew Odom's full review on Austin 360 right now or in Friday's print edition of the Austin American Statesman. Matthew Odom, restaurant critic for the Statesman, appreciate your time, sir.
Always a pleasure, Nathan.
That, my friend, is KUT Weekend for the first weekend of May 2016. You can subscribe to this podcast at weekend.kut.org. Send any questions or comments to news@kut.org. You can reach me directly, nathan@kut.org. Our theme music is by RAC. Thanks again for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5 at kut.org. ¶¶